We were sophomores in high school, and it was October of our sophomore year. She wasn't yet 15. She turned 15 in November, but she married an older man. I turned 15 in October, or in August, so I had already turned 15. And a guy by the name of Nicky Chavers came to TCA. And I see some nodding of heads, some of the older goobas among us, the groaning up born agains among us. Remember that Nicky Chavers had a group of, for lack of a better term, a Christian version of Shakespearean players. Pastor Kevin Shaw actually toured with him one summer and did, in church after church after church, did Reader's Theater and acted out Christian scenes and things like that. He was really good. And of course, we were very small and had very limited facilities and didn't have a Daryl DeGraw or an Eric Payne or people that could do speech and help us with plays and all that kind of stuff, or a Dave Sturz, but we didn't have any of those kind of people. And he would kind of come in as a one-man band stand and bring in like one or two people, and we would get the script months at a time. So we got a script in August, and it was October, and they had gone around and picked out people that could do parts. And so the title of the play that we were going to do is called A Venture Almost Desperate. And it's the story of the Apostle Paul. But in this story of the Apostle Paul, he goes back and he is talking about this scene, 1 Samuel 17. And it's kind of done in a Reader's Theater format. And they needed a guy cast member and a girl cast member. And God had the person doing the casting pick me to be the guy and my wife to be the girl. Interestingly enough, my wife had just gotten saved the week before in a Ron Comfort evangelistic meeting. She had just gotten saved. She was so excited about that. And so we did this scene. Well, we memorized the entire the chapter of 1 Samuel 17, she and I did. And we did it back and forth. And when we do it tonight, you're gonna see it's like 50 some odd verses long. It's quite a long passage. And we had to memorize it because we had different parts of the verses, and it was word for word. We would tell the story, and we had to tell it with expression, and we had to tell it like we were actually there narrating the story. So it's like the man on the scene, here comes Goliath, here comes David. And it was done to a cassette tape. So there was music to it. So we had to have the right cadence and the right speed, because when the rock went through the air, there's a sound that would take place. And if you said any flew through, the rock went through the air, and then, you know, you had to have it. Literally, you had to say the entire 52 or whatever verses in the right speed and the right cadence. So my wife and I, literally, we were out of class the whole week. This was a drama that we were going to do. And so we had gotten it. And then that week, they were helping us with cadence and all the different actors and actresses. And so my wife and I spent almost the entire week, all through the day. After I spent a week with her, I was in love. We had so bonded over this text of scripture and memorizing it together and citing it together and working on it together and then performing it together. I was completely hooked. I was 15 years old, and I could not believe that anybody, I had found a girl, a woman that loved the Bible as much as I did. So this story has this text. In fact, as I'm studying through it and I'm reading it again, I can actually hear the tape in my head at the different inflection points. And this would be 40 years ago now. I can hear the tape of the music running in my head at the different breaks and the verses and where I was supposed to stop and where she was supposed to begin. It's another reason why I love Christian schools, the emphasis that it puts on you to learn the text of Scripture and bury it in your heart. Mrs. Singleton commented to me tonight about me using scripture from all over the Bible and wrapping it into the text. And my comment to her was, that's Christian school education, and it's godly parents. That's what that is. That's Christian school education and godly parents. And by God's grace, I've had the privilege of studying all my life and being paid to study the Bible, which is a wonderful gift that my congregations have given to me. But a Christian school education and godly parents. My mom is back there. I want to say, Mom, I was maybe 8 or 9, maybe 9. And we memorized almost all of 1 John together. Do you remember doing that? She said to me, she goes, you're getting into too much mischief. She probably doesn't remember this, but I do. You're getting into too much mischief. I need to keep you busy. You're such an active. So you and I are going to memorize 1 John together. And I think we memorized up to about the end of 1 John 4. And we spent about 3 months and we worked on it every single day. We memorized 1 John, a 9-year-old boy who was very, very active and his mother trying to get Jesus into him. 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together into battle and were gathered in Succoth, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and they camped in the valley of Elah and drew up at the battle in array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side and Israel stood on a mountain on the other with a valley in between them. I want you to notice number one tonight that God creates. This is a chapter about God. I even said earlier, one of my favorite stories about David and Goliath, but you realize the story isn't about David and Goliath. The story is about God. David and Goliath just get to be characters in God's story. It's all about God. Do you realize that God creates the setting for victory? I want to make this application to you. God creates the setting for victory. Now, what we're going to see in the text is we know the end, right? We know he's going to chop the head off and hold his hand. And I'm going to give you a new idea of what I think it means when it says David took the head to Jerusalem. Just wait till the closer, because I don't think you've ever heard what I'm going to tell you what I think that means, which is really amazing if you stop and think about it. But We know the end. It's like if you really are pulling for a team. I've used this illustration before, 2001. I'm a huge baseball fan. I have never pulled for a winning team that's won it all in football, baseball, basketball, because I've been a Phoenix Suns fan. I was a Los Angeles Rams fan forever. And then when they finally won the Super Bowl, I'd started pulling for the Cardinals the year before. So I couldn't even claim the Los Angeles Rams for a Super Bowl. And I was a San Francisco Giant fan all my life growing up. And then I became a Diamondback fan just when the Giants started to win World Series again, you know? So, I mean, I've rarely ever switched teams, and the 2 times I did it to pull for an Arizona team, my California teams then won Super Bowls and World Series, so I couldn't claim them. So I get to 2001, and I mean, like, so excited, and we get to that last game of the World Series, and oh, man, we've got Mariano Rivera on the mound, and we're down by a run. He's the greatest ace of all time out of the bullpen, and we're not going to win. And my family kicked me out of the living room and told me I couldn't be there because I was bothering them so much by pacing. And then I came back in for the final hit by Luis Gonzalez, and we won the World Series. And I was jumping up and down. And about 2 days later, the game was replayed, and I watched the last 3 innings on replay, and I was like, oh, I'm not worried. We got behind. No big deal. We got this. Now, you'd have to be a sports fan to understand what it was like going through it the first time and then going through it a second time. We go through 1 Samuel 17 the second time. I want us to go into the sandals of the Jews and understand what God was doing. Be there that day. You are looking at a giant that's 9 feet tall. Your average soldier is 5'5". Your king is probably 5'10 or 6 feet, and he was a monster, head and shoulders above everybody else. Saul was no more than 6 feet tall. Goliath, at a minimum, was 9 feet. Some theologians say he was likely 9'9". In other words, he would go out onto our basketball court, and his head would be about that far from touching the rim. Could you imagine the basketball contract that guy could get? I mean, he looks down to dunk. I mean, just goes, it's like playing Nerf basketball in a 4-foot rim to him or something like that, right? He's 9+ feet tall. And David is likely about half his size. David is a teenager, no more than about 5.5 feet tall, and they are going to battle. Do you understand that God arranges this difficult situation for the fame of His name to be promulgated? He is creating in your life sometimes right now difficult situations, problematic situations, uncomfortable situations, hard situations, so that the fame of His name will be revealed as God gets the glory, as you yield to Him and walk in the Spirit. God is the hero of this story, like He is the hero of Ruth's story, like He is the hero of Esther's story. God is the hero of all of these stories because it is His story. God creates the setting for victory. You got a couple of slides back there? So let's look at the Valley of Elah. This is actually looking from the Israelite camp. So let me get my pointer out here. By the way, I plan on going back to Israel in 3 years. So if you want to go with me in 3 years, probably late May, early June, sometime like that in, 2022? So keep that. Save your shekels. Since we're talking about Israel, save your shekels. Save your shekels. Boy, some of you are really slow tonight. You didn't get that. So right here, this hill line right here was the Goliath. This is the Philistine hill line. We are about 10 miles, 15 miles southwest of Jerusalem. We're going down toward the Mediterranean Sea. As we're going to move, the next shot is going to be to the left, and the next shot is going to be further to the left. But this is the Valley of Elah. So remember, this looks like a wheat field. This is the Valley of Elah. Right, this right here is the dry creek bed that David would have picked up his stones from. Now, I got to tell you this. I have 5 smooth stones on my shelf from the Valley of Elah. They aren't the same ones from when David was there. The nation of Israel has a pile of stones about 10 miles away. A huge pile. In fact, Lake, you got a picture of it, don't you? They have a huge pile of stones about 10 miles away that at every couple of years, they go in there every year or so. They go in there and they fill up the truck with stones and they cart the stones down the Valley of Elah for all the tourists. Because a long time ago, this story took place 3,000 years ago. A long, 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 long time ago, all the stones were gone from the Valley of Elah, okay? but this valley is very well attested historically. So this is the line. If you go further over that hill line, about 5 or 6 miles, you come to get the ancient city of Gath. If you go about another 10 or 15 miles, you're in modern Gaza. So you're about 15 miles. So artillery fire from Gaza, when they fire those rockets, they can actually fly about this far. They don't, but they can. So this is the Valley of Elah. You want to give me the next slide? So we're moving left. So what you saw before was over here. Okay? So go back one slide. Go back to the slide before. So we're moving this way. The next slide is over here. Keep going. So this ridge line, go back a slide, extends all the way across here. So that's the battle line. I'm sorry, I'm taking this with my phone. Okay, stop being critical in your head. So anyway, go left again, Trevor. So this here is, right in through here is the creek. I don't think David called it a creek, but that's my southwestern Pennsylvania background. So right in through here, somewhere in through this area, is where David would have fought Goliath. And he would have come, next slide, off of this mountain ridge. So I kept going left with you. You can see a little bit of the field right here. The last shot was here, and the other shot was over here. So I've taken you on about a 90-degree turn with those 3 camera shots. So the Israelite camp was here. If you go over that ridge line, about 14 miles, you come to Bethlehem. So if you went that way, that's the way David would come. So David would come every once in a while and bring food. We're going to see that in the text tonight. So you can kind of get an idea of down here. David's going to come off of this ridge line. There's a creek bed right in here. He's going to pick up the stones. Next slide. Go back one slide, Trevor. And he's going to come out into this area here. Go back one more slide. Nope. I'm sorry. Yeah. So through here and off to the right, this is where that battle took place. So you can see the distance is not much. The distance is not much. So remember, in the ancient world, shooting arrows, it's not like you see in the movies. Because they hadn't invented the longbow or the compound bow, arrows were not very effective. In other words, an arrow to be effective with not having a longbow, which isn't invented till the Battle of Agincourt in the 1200s, or the compound bow, in David's time they didn't have that. So they just had a very simple bow, and what would happen is you would often pull the string back and the wood couldn't hold the tension, and you would snap the bow. So it was very bows and arrows in David and Goliath's era. From the back of auditorium to the wall, that was about the extent of any kind of archery accuracy. It's not like, you know, you see them 300 and they fly, you know, hundreds of yards and kill everybody. That doesn't happen for 2,000 more years. So what we're going to find out is the ancients, you even see it in the battle with the Benjamites in the book of Judges, they had slingers. They had slingers. A slingshot was way more powerful and way more effective. If you put 800-900 guys, it says in Judges they were left-handed, I would be right-handed, right? If you put 800 or 900 guys with rocks, and we're not talking pebbles, we're talking these are half pound to pound and a half rocks, and they sling and they're that accurate, you are dropping a fusillade. Now remember, they didn't have the armor that we see like in the Middle Ages, you know, the knight. That's not, it was more leather. Leather with maybe copper or iron fitted over them. So literally, if you hit a direct hit with a rock onto that helmet, you probably kill the guy through the helmet because it's not thick enough and it's not heavy enough. It was more for a slashing blow to protect the head from a sword. But most men in those days didn't even go to war with a helmet. You don't get helmets for 500 years later with the Greek hoplites. So the headdresses that we have on the Assyrians and the Babylonians are more stylistic rather than they are actual prevent damage in war. You don't get helmets till about 500 BC. So this is the field of battle. David is going to pick up a rock, five of them, because it's a more potent at distance offensive weapon than what a arrow would have ever been. So let's look at the text and we're going to draw some principles out of it. There we go. How about if I leave that picture up? Because it's probably in the middle of that field where this story takes place. So I'll leave that picture up so as we go through the text tonight. God sets the setting for victory. But notice number two, God allows his name to be blasphemed. And I've never thought of that before until I'm taking my mind through this. So this is a story about God. God allowed his name to be blasphemed. I don't think if I was God, I would allow people to use the oxygen I created and the sunlight from the sun that I created and the planet that I created and the food that I had created and use the energy from their body that I had created for them to blaspheme my name. But God does that. Notice verse 4. It says, and a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, probably on that ridge line there, or this ridge line here. They're right next to each other. He came out of that camp. The camp comes out of the Philistines, named Goliath, and he was 6 cubits in a span, which means he was somewhere between 9 foot and 9.5 feet to 9 foot 9. He had a bronze helmet on his head, but in those days, don't mistake a bronze helmet to think of some great steel helmet. Bronze was very susceptible to a rock, to a sword. It was very susceptible. It wasn't as strong a metal as what we're going to get later in history. He said he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Okay, so let's understand the javelin. It's not what we think is a javelin. It's more like a scimitar sword. So think of an Arab sword, if you think in Arab, and it's the curved blade sword. That's most likely what this is. The Philistines were probably Asiatic people, not European people. They were probably Asiatic people, maybe from Turkey. We're not exactly sure. But he would have had it in the middle of his back. So he would have, in a battle situation, so he has a spear that he's going to throw. But if he gets close in combat, he's going to pull out this scimitar, this curved sword, and use it for close in combat. So he's got both. So he's got this spear. So I don't want, when I have read this in the past, I've thought, oh my goodness, he had a spear and a javelin. Well, they're the same thing. The javelin was not what we think of a javelin. It would have been a scimitar kind of sword between his shoulders, meaning it's on his back. So he would pull it out like this for close combat. And it says the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels. 5,000 shekels. That is his chest protection weighed 125 pounds. 125 pounds. That's the bulk of this guy. That's his Kevlar vest. I was talking to one of our, way back in the day, 2003, 2004, one of our guys came back from the Iraqi Freedom there at the 161st, and he had been a cop at a POW camp in Al-Nasiriya. And Al-Nasiriya, out in the desert, and he wore Kevlar, and he wore water. He had his water, and he had his gun, and he had his rounds, and he had ammo. I said, how much will you carry in the summertime as you walk? And he was walking post 12 hours a day. He said, Chaplain, I was carrying 55 to 60 pounds of extra weight every day. And he said, in 3 months, he said, I lost 65 pounds. He said, I came back just skin and bones because he said I was carrying 55 to 60 pounds of weight. This guy was carrying on his chest 125 pounds. You need to get a feel for how mammoth this guy is. He's as tall as a basketball hoop and he's walking around on his chest carrying 125 pounds. He had bronze of armor on his legs and bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now, the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and at 600 shekels, the head of that spear weighed 15 pounds. That's not the shaft. That's the head, the sharpened edge, 15 pounds. Can you imagine this guy throwing it and him pinning you with the head of that shaft, 15 pounds? I mean, nobody's going to live through that. Nobody's going to live through if he jabs you with that. 15 pounds is the weight. This is a massive guy. Then he stood up and he cried to the armies of Israel. So he is here, somewhere along here, and they are here. I mean, that distance isn't more than 150 yards. It's maybe not even 125 yards. It's easy for someone to stand 50 yards into that field and everybody hears him. Everybody hears him. And he cries, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Well, that's a pretty bold declaration. So who was supposed to go down and do the fighting? The guy that was head and shoulders above everybody else. It's hard for us to understand in modern warfare because we have guns and we shoot and, you know, and we do all this kind of stuff. But their warfare, remember what I just got done saying about an archer? You know, we see these movies where they shoot and, you know, everybody gets hit and then they reload and they shoot again and everybody gets hit and they reload. So you think about men running with very little armor on. Generally, they were in sandals, some type of a short skirt or something like that. Very light, maybe a light shield of some kind, and a mattock or a sword. That was pretty much their, what they, running across the field like that, when you're getting shot at by arrows, let me tell you something, you can run really fast. To cover 30 yards, 40 yards, which was the effective range of that arrow, maybe 50 yards, you can do that relatively fastly. You get off a couple of volleys of arrows, and the bad guys or the other side is on top of you in hand-to-hand combat. You have to get that kind of a picture in your head to understand all combat in those days was hand-to-hand. It was up close and personal. So when you had a guy that was 9 feet tall, with a spearhead that was 15 pounds, with a scimitar sword that he could just do this kind of thing. I mean, he would just cut down 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 people just over, I mean, just boom, 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 boom. He was going to win almost every battle. And standing in front of him is an armor bearer. The armor bearer is carrying probably a moving shield that he would just walk forward like this with the shield. The shield was probably about 6 feet tall. So the shield probably came up to midway, and the armor bearer, if he was normal height for that time, was smaller than the shield. So he's behind the shield, just moving it forward into battle. So that Saul, or rather that Goliath, can't be hit by an arrow. He would move the shield to protect him. When he cries out to Israel, Saul should have responded. But I want you to notice this. Number three, God had removed his spirit from Saul with the resultant fear of man. So God allowed his name to be blasphemed because it was going to bring greater glory to him. God allows today his name to be blasphemed because it brings greater glory to him when those who have blasphemed him will eventually be put down and they will have to kneel and say, Jesus is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. But I want you to notice, thirdly, Saul is now terrified. Do you remember when we first saw Saul? I mean, he rallied the nation and they marched overnight with 100,000 troops to save his birthplace, where probably his great-grandmother was from in modern-day Jordan. I mean, he doesn't take guff from anybody. Do you know why? Because the Spirit of God was on him. Saul knew that the Spirit had departed him. He knew that he was not in right relationship with God. Do you realize when you're not walking in right relationship with God, that's why you're angry. That's why you struggle with bitterness. That's why you struggle in your marriage. That's why when you know you're not in a right relationship with God, the turmoil on the inside of you causes problems. You read some of these people that write horrible, horrible things about people that are Christians, and you realize it's turmoil inside of them. They're being convicted by God, and they're fighting against God, as God's said to Saul on the road to Damascus, it's tough to kick against the pricks. Like that ox, that cow that's kicking against the goad when they're in the field. And they don't want to be there, and they kick back and it hits them on the ankle, and they hit back and it hits them on the back of the calf. They're not happy. It's tough to do that. Stop it. Just go to the field and do your work, is what the owner of that donkey would say, or that ox would say that's plowing in the field. Saul knew that God had removed his spirit from him, and Saul knew he couldn't do this. Notice what it says in verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. God removed his spirit from Saul with the resultant fear of man. When God's Spirit is removed, I become afraid of man. When I'm not in a right relationship with God, I become fearful of man. I'm in a right relationship with God. I can go to the stake, as many Christian martyrs have done, and say, be brave. I can be like Felix Mons and say, no, baptism should only be for believers. And the Protestant reformer Zwingli and the town council of Zurich took him into the river there in Zurich. And there's a plaque there. You can go there today and see right where they threw him in the river and say, you want to be baptized? We'll baptize you permanently. And they threw Felix Mons in the river. telling him, you need to sprinkle your child. And Mons said, no, it's not in the Bible. He was in his 20s and he died for the cause of Jesus Christ. Because when you're right with God, you're bold toward men. When you're right with God, you're bold toward men because you know you're walking with God. You know you're in His will. Saul knows he's not in God's will and he's terrified. And now he's going to be upstaged probably by a teenager, probably not more than 14 or 15, maybe 16, but one who's walking with God, who's singing to God, who's praising God, who's trusting God, who's worshiping God, who's obeying God. And this teenager, probably not more than 5'5 or 5'6, is going to stand toe-to-toe with a 9-foot-plus giant and put the king of Israel to shame. But that's the difference between a man right with God and a man not right with God. God removed his spirit from Saul with the resultant fear of man. Number four, God provided a man, though, to rescue his people. Number four, God provided a man to rescue his people. God always provides a man to rescue his people. God always does. It may not be in our timing. It may not be the way we like. But God always provides someone to rescue his people if they will turn to him. Verse 12, it says, now David was the son of Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons. And the man was old and advanced in years. And the day of Saul, the 3 oldest sons, Jesse, had gone to follow Saul to the battle. So Jesse is too old to go to the battle. And 5 of the sons, with David being the youngest, is too young. Or the other couple are given a deferral because they need him on the farm. I'm not sure, but David's probably in his teens, 14, 15, 16. The reason this spoke to me when Elm and I were doing this was David was probably, I had just turned 15, and I was saying to myself, would I have this kind of, I'm his age. I'm his age. And he faced down a giant. When the king was too afraid and his brother was scoffing him, and he still had faith and confidence in God that I can do this with the power of God. It was a very transformational experience as a child, as a young man, as a teenager. David was the youngest, Eliab the firstborn next to him, and Abinadab, and then the third, Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep of Bethlehem. Remember, Bethlehem is that way, over that ridgeline, 10 miles. Jerusalem's about 14 miles. Jerusalem is this direction, about 14 miles. Bethlehem is that direction, about 10 miles. So 10-mile walk, we think, oh my goodness, 10 miles, that was nothing. He was a shepherd out in the Judean wilderness. That 10 miles was get up in the morning and get out of there about 6 o'clock, and by 9:30 I'll be at the battle. It was like a commute. He became a commuter to the battle. He would occasionally go to the battle. And he ran and returned to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistines drew near. Undoubtedly, as we're going to see, his older brothers were jealous of him. He had been anointed king of Israel. They were jealous of him. And he kept annoying them. You know, you're the firstborn, and this, you have 7 brothers, and he's the little one, and the old prophet had come down and anointed him king of Israel. What does that old prophet know? My little brother's nothing. I smack him around. I can remember my mom was pregnant with him. You know, you can imagine what was going through Eliab's head. And Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. It's interesting, the number 40, Jesus spent time in the wilderness that would be about that direction on this map, about 15 miles that way. Jesus spent 40 days and 40 nights to be tempted by God, or tempted by Satan. We know it rained 40 days and 40 nights. And God allows Goliath 40 days to blaspheme him. Wow. The long suffering of God with us, with Goliath, 40 days of nothing but blaspheming. And nobody in the camp of Israel was going to defend God's name. Then Jesse said to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephah of dried grain. So he's telling him to take him about a bushel and a half, or a half a bushel of roasted or parched grain to his brothers, about a half a bushel, and then 10 slices of cheese to his commander, maybe Abner, who is going to come into the scene later on in the text. So David rose and early in the morning, verse 20, and left the sheep with the keeper and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the camp, probably a 4 or 5 hour walk, 10 miles-ish. He came to the camp as the army was going out to the fight. So it's morning. Remember, he's coming morning and evening. I love David. He was an early riser, college students. He got up and he walked 10 miles before the giant came out in the morning. He'd already walked his 10. He'd done his PT. He'd already been to the gym. He was ready for fight. He'd already worked out. And he said, I've already worked out, done a 10-mile hike. I'm ready to fight a giant before 8 o'clock in the morning. David rose early in the morning and left the sheep, and he came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up the battle in array. Undoubtedly, the battle line would have been right about here. And if I go back, running right through this line right here, and their battle line, the Philistine battle line, would have been right along that line right there, and extending on down this way into this little gap. So that's where the Philistine battle line. So when you see the distance here is only about 75 yards between the battle lines. 75 to 100 yards. So it's like a bunch of people lining up at one end of a football field and a bunch of people lining up at the other end of the football field and yelling at each other. Oh, we do that every Saturday in the football season, right? So anyway, it was going to be a scrum. It says, for Israel and the Philistines had drawn up battle in array, and David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper and ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, Philistine of Gath. He comes out in the middle of that battle, so if that's a 100-yard difference, Goliath comes out 50 yards. If it's a 75-yard difference, he's coming out 35 yards. It's not that far. This is not a long distance. It's not a long distance. He comes out into the middle of that and he comes and he spoke according to those same words that he's been saying for 40 days and 40 nights. So David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, they fled. So they would have, if we take the picture, they would have been along this battle line right in here, and they run back up the hill. Why? Because if Goliath comes after them, they want him to be fighting uphill. They want him to be saying, throw rocks down on him. So they turn around and they flee. And all the men of Israel flee. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter and give him his father's house exemption from taxes. That's enough to risk your life. The IRS no longer bothers you and you don't have to fill out tax forms. I will risk my life for that any day in the week. No taxes. And David spoke with the men that stood by him saying, what shall be done to the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Notice, he wasn't interested in tax relief. He wasn't interested in all the other earthly accoutrements. He says, what will be done to take away the reproach from Israel? What is going to be done? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? As opposed to the Philistines' God, Dagon, who was a dead god. Do you remember back? The story of Samson takes place 15 or 20 miles from here. Remember when they took Samson? And Dagon, what? What did Dagon do? He fell down. And his hands and his feet and the head was on the threshold. That's why the Philistines step over the threshold, because their fake god fell down. You know, a lot of people's fake God is politics. I was reading to my Bible class a quote from Lenin. Quote from Lenin this week, in which he said, socialism, the goal of socialism is to replace God with government. That's a quote from Vladimir Lenin. Why is it that so many Americans today want socialism? They want socialism because they need another God, and they've thrown the real God out, and so they need another God to worship, and so they worship government. It doesn't matter that we have Venezuela, one of the young men today, saying to me, it's a disaster. I would do anything to get away from socialism. He said, I come to America, and he said, I would do anything. And someone of my friends said to me today, and he said, in our country is running to socialism, and here is a guy that's only known socialism. He's 19, and there's food lines and children starving and no medicine. Why? Because the goal of socialism, according to Lenin, is to take God down and replace God with government, because man was made to worship. Man will worship something. In Goliath's case, he had a dead god. He had Dagon. That when the Ark of the Covenant had come into the Philistine camp two generations before, Dagon had fallen down and was a dead god. All the Israelites knew they worshipped a living god, but the Philistines worshipped a dead god. He says, the armies of the living God, and I want you to notice, the people answered him in this manner, saying, so shall it be done for the man who kills him. I want you to notice number 5. God allows discouragement to attack his man. So God creates the setting for victory. God allowed his name to be blasphemed. God removed his spirit from Saul with the resultant fear of man. God provided a man to rescue his people. It's not the guy they thought was going to do it. Little teenager, scrawny, but a man who had a heart and a passion for God. That was God's requirement. Remember when Samuel had anointed him the chapter before? He said to Samuel, don't look at Eliab. Don't look at the outward appearance, because we're about to hear the heart of Eliab. This is the heart that God knew. He said, if we pick Eliab, we'll have a worse problem than we have with Saul. Yeah, he's got the right pedigree. Yes, he's from Ruth. Yes, he's from Judah. Yes, he's in the right genetic line, but his heart is wrong. The same mother and father that gave us David also gave us Eliab. That's a great one for us to think of as parents. In other words, Eliab chose one course. David chose another. You read in the Psalms where David talks about being opposed even by his brothers. I wonder if he wasn't thinking about this scene. Who knows? But both of them had the same gene pool, but one had a passion for God and another one had a passion for self. God had said to Samuel, do not look at Eliab's big figure. I'm looking for a man with a heart for me, a passion for me. That's the little 12-year-old over there. Because David was probably 12 or 13 when he's anointed for kingship. We read in verse 28 that Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the man, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David. I read a commentator on this, and he said, obviously, Eliab didn't know David had been anointed to be king. I was like, obviously not. Obviously, he had known that David had been anointed king. And he was annoyed at his little brother for coming down and pretending. It's just like Joseph all over again, isn't it? It's just like Joseph all over again. The older brothers were all annoyed at Joseph. He was number 11 of 12. He says, what have you... He said, why did you come down here? And with whom you've left those few scraggly sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride. Actually, it's called transference, right? He was the one with pride, and he was looking in a mirror. He was insolent. against God's anointed. He was insolent against God's choice. He was proud in his being the firstborn, and he was going to inherit everything, and he was the boss. He said, I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, and you've just come down to see the battle. And David has a great response, because when you're right with God, you can be bold toward men. And he says, what have I done? Isn't there a cause? Isn't there God's name to be defended? He's basically smacking him verbally in the face and say, you've been sitting here for 40 days and 40 nights listening to this guy blaspheme God 80 times, the living God. Why haven't you gone out to fight him? Isn't there a cause? I say to this church right now, there will still be a cause of worldwide evangelism until Jesus comes. There will still be a cause of training the next generation until Jesus comes. There will still be a cause of winning men and women and boys and girls to Jesus Christ until Jesus comes, until you take your last breath. There will always be a cause for God's kingdom to go forward. There will always be a cause that men will blaspheme his name. There will always be those who will discourage you as Eliab attempted to discourage David. Could you imagine if David had taken his brother at his word and said, oh, you're right. We wouldn't have this great story. David, we wouldn't have all the truth of this story. We wouldn't have the victory of faith, the victory of trust. There will always be a cause to stand against evil and to stand against your brethren who wish to discourage you from the cause that God has called you to. There will always be a cause. David says, stop trying to discourage me. Stop trying to look at me and say, I'm insolent and I'm proud. Then number six, and lastly, God prepared an unlikely hero who had prepared himself spiritually and skillfully for this moment, never knowing when God would need him. Let me say that again. God prepared an unlikely hero who had prepared himself. We're going to see it here in a second. If he just that morning picked up a slingshot, he would have been Goliath meat. God prepared an unlikely hero who had prepared himself spiritually and skillfully. He had prepared himself spiritually and skillfully. In other words, he trusted God. We're going to see in a second, he's going to tell Saul, when Saul says, you can't do this, he goes, I've killed bears, lions. You know, when a lion's running you down, he's a little bit quicker than that guy with a 125-pound sheet of... I'm quicker than... I can kill him. God saved me from a lion and a bear. I got this. With God's help, I got this. The same God that delivered me from them, he's going to deliver me now. Me and God, we're good. He's going to be dead before the day's over. God prepared an unlikely hero who had prepared himself spiritually and skillfully. I don't know what he was doing when he was 9 or 10. He's got 30, 40 sheep out in the backside of the Judean desert. If you've ever seen a picture of it, makes the Arizona desert look really populated. You get about a half inch to an inch of rain a year. I can see David out there, 10 years old. Every other shepherd boy is like, oh, Dad, send me out here. David's got a slingshot. He's lining his little rocks up on a ledge. And I mean, what are you doing with sheep? They graze and they sleep and they get water. What do you do with the rest of your day? There's not a lot to do out there. He didn't, listen to me, young people, college students, high school students, he didn't waste his life. In his teens and his 20s, he didn't waste his life. As a child, as a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy, he wasn't wasting his life, frittering it away. He was preparing himself for what God would call him to, even though he never knew what it was. God provided an unlikely hero who had prepared himself spiritually and skillfully for this moment, never knowing when God would need him. He had prepared himself the skill set and the spiritual trust. He had prepared himself in both ways, never knowing when God would need him, but confident that God could use him somehow. God never uses an empty vessel. He overflows out of a vessel that's full. Let's read the story. Now the words which David spoke were heard, and they reported to Saul, and he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, "Don't you let your heart fail you. Your servant will go and fight him. Hey, you king, I'm just a teenager, but me and God, we got this. Don't get discouraged. I'm not listening to Eliab. He didn't know what he's talking about." David was confident in his God. Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him. You are a youth, and he a man of war. When Goliath was your age, he was already learning how to fight." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it." In other words, I took action. I'm a man of action. I saw danger, and there was a lion with a lamb in its mouth, and I chased the lion down. You're not taking what's mine. You're not stealing what's mine. You're not stealing my dad's lamb. And he said, "I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from his mouth." Wow, that's something else. Little lamb, pry open the mouth and pull the lamb out. Bloody carcass. I mean, this was a man of action. I went out after and struck and delivered the lamb out of its mouth. And when it rose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. We're talking about a 13-year-old kid. 14-year-old kid. "Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." Living God. Living God. Notice it's a living, he's a living God. Moreover, David, why did David know he was a living God? Because David had been on the backside of the desert singing songs to him, and God's spirit was on him, and God was empowering him, and he was in a relationship with God, and he had boldness because he was right with God. And he said, "This same God will deliver me that has delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear. He will deliver me from the hands of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, Saul out of his own mouth acknowledges that the Spirit of God is on David. And he says, "Go and the Lord be with you." So Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put a bronze helmet on his head. And he clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened his sword to his armor, tried to walk. It says he'd not tested him, but what it means is he's wearing the football uniform of a guy 6 foot and he's 5'5". He said, "I can't walk with these. I haven't tested them." In other words, I'm going to depend on speed. I would be a sitting duck with all this. So David took him off. He has probably what we would call a short skirt. He has a pouch, a staff. Then he took his staff in his hand, a stick, a staff, maybe a crook on the end of it, which he used to rescue sheep, and put them in a shepherd's. He took 5 smooth stones, probably weighing a pound apiece, maybe 3/4 of a pound to 1 1/4 pounds, and put them in a shepherd's bag in a pouch, which he had, and his sling was in his hand. He drew near to the Philistine. I love the smack talking. They didn't have basketball or football, you know. They smack talked, right? When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. For he was only a youth, he's half his size. David probably didn't weigh 105 pounds. Maybe 110. I mean, the chest protector of Goliath weighed more than David. Philistine came and he saw him, and the man that bore the shield went before him, verse 42. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he's only a youth and ruddy and good looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come with me with sticks?" He wasn't even pointy. It was a shepherd's crook. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." And Saul was terrified, and David was confident. Then David said to the Philistine, wow, this is quite the smackdown. We could do a mic drop right here when we're done with this, right? You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. See, a man who's right with God is bold toward men. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. He's 9'5". David's 5'5". They're going to be in a field of battle 30 yards apart. Wow. I will strike you and take your head from you. He had a stick and a slingshot. How is he going to take his... Think this through. How is he going to run into that field and take his head? It means I'm going to take your sword to take your head. You stop and think of what he's... Because he has no instrument. He's not going to get out his little rock and... and saw his head off. He's not going to take his crook, his shepherd's crook, and there's no way to sever it. He's literally saying to Goliath, I am going to beat you so bad that I'm going to take your own sword away from you and then chop your head off with it. And then he goes on to say, this day the Lord will, and this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistine to the bird. In other words, I'm not just going to kill you. I'm going to kill everybody up on that hill. Do you people hear me? I'm not just killing the 9-foot giant. I'm coming after you when I'm done with him. I love it. You think what he's saying. He says, I am going to give the carcasses, plural, of the camp. I am going to give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts. In other words, the battle's going to be so complete that no one will be left to bury the dead. Because the birds are going to come and eat you. That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, because I don't got one. You got a 15-pound head on your spear. I got news for you. You ain't going to be using it in about 30 seconds. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. So it was when the Philistine arose and came, drew near to meet David. David hurried and ran to the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a sword and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. So the stone sank into his forehead. Undoubtedly, a serious concussion knocked him out flat. So we're talking maybe a distance from me to the back wall, maybe from that wall to the back wall. David's running on the move to be a more difficult target for the spear, but still within range of the stone, but not in range of his scimitar, but moving so fast that he can't get the spear back and throw it. And David running like this, and he has a target of probably no more than that, and he's moving, and Goliath is moving. This is something Tom Brady couldn't do. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on the face of the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. But I love Samuel's comment. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine. So he's standing right here, right in this area. There's the line of the Philistines, 35 yards away. He is now standing, this little boy, 115 pounds, over this giant who's face down, and he reaches down and takes the sword. The Philistine line is, what, at that wall? Maybe a little bit behind that wall? Maybe the other side of the gymnasium, the distance? And he takes the sword in plain view of thousands of soldiers and takes out his own sword and hacks and hacks like he would be cutting up a lamb or cutting up a bear or cutting up a lion. And he hacks the head off and he picks up Goliath's head and he says, "This was the one that defied the armies of Israel. This was the one that defied God." Therefore, David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it, just as he had predicted. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Now the men of Israel and Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and the gates of Ekron, which was miles away. Doing exactly what David had predicted, as they killed on the way, leaving the carcasses of the camp, they ran over that ridge line and down the other side. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and they plundered their tents. They took all their food, they took their gold, they took everything from their tents. And I want you to notice the next verse. I've always wondered about this, and I thought. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. Now we know from later in Samuel that David's going to take Jerusalem. Jerusalem was about a 12 to 13 acre. The old city is about 12 to 13 acres. So it's the old city of Jerusalem is about the size and acreage of Tri-City Baptist Church property. But it had steep clip lines, if you've been there with me, on every side except the north side. And a very difficult city to attack. David is going to take it away from the Jebusites later. But the Jebusites are a city right in the middle of Judah. This is David's home area. Remember, he's in Bethlehem growing up 5 miles away from Jerusalem. Here's what I think happened. If you read the text, you might think, oh, he took the head back to his capital. It wasn't his capital. He's a teenage boy. It's not going to become his capital for another 30 years, 20 years. Here's what I think he did. Everybody knew Goliath. I mean, he was front page headline of the Gazette Desert News. I mean, the Gaza Desert News. I mean, here's what I think he did. I think he took the head. Now I'm guessing. And he went to the wall of the Jebusites and threw the head over the wall. And he said, "I'm coming for you guys next." This is what happens to those who oppose the God of Israel. Here's his head. Remember those Philistines down there 20 miles away? I just killed their biggest guy. I don't know if that's what that means, but Judah didn't own Jerusalem. Jebusites did. Takes the head, he brings it to Jerusalem, but he put the armor in his tent. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander, so this is maybe the guy that David gave the cheese to, "Abner, whose son is this youth? I mean, where does he come from?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, I don't know." So the king said, "Inquire whose son this young man is." He'd been playing the harp for him, but obviously he was so insignificant. Samuel is saying that he's so insignificant that Saul doesn't even remember where he came from. Then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. He's going to go later and take it to Jerusalem. Talk about your trophy, right? A bleeding head of an ugly Philistine. You're just wandering around with it. Like a rugby, you know? I don't know how you carry the head of bleeding. You're just wandering around with this thing. And he has the head of the Philistine. Can you imagine, honestly, how chagrined Saul is? He should have been walking with the head. Remember the two chapters before with the Amalekites, how he'd built the style to himself? This is a guy that wants the glory for himself. This is when they start cheering, he's killed his thousands, but David is 10,000s. He's going to get really angry. And Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And Saul said, "I am your son, the son of your servant, Jesse, the Bethlehemite." God prepared an unlikely hero who had prepared himself spiritually and skillfully for this moment, never knowing when his God would need him. Are you preparing yourself spiritually and skillfully? I don't care how old you are. Are you preparing yourself spiritually and skillfully because you don't know when God is going to need you? David did. What a great example. Father, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for its truth.